Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The America's Most Challenging High School Index is released every year, listing high schools around the nation that rank the number of students who take AP International Baccalaureate and Cambridge tests. Jay Matthews of The Washington Post created the list, and WFAE asked him to look into Charlotte schools. He did, and this morning he shares what he's discovered. That's first, and later we hear from a former CMS superintendent who pressed for greater AP participation, and from the current chief equity officer for our schools. But first, Jay Matthews joins us by phone from Pasadena, where it's very early in the morning and all kinds of alarms are going off. Good morning and welcome to the program.
Hi, Mike.
Hi. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, search for WFAE on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. So as I understand it, Mr. Matthews, you have worked for The Washington Post for 50 years, and of the 9 books that you have written, 5 are about high school. And you're also
only 47 years, but it's getting up to 50.
Okay, well, you're also the creator of the annual Challenge Index, which I just talked about, which ranks America's most challenging high schools. Why your interest in high schools? Are they the cornerstones of a successful life and career?
They are for me. I think they are the most interesting and important thing to talk about when you're talking about American education, and particularly the place where we've had the best and most interesting changes and improvements. This started for me, I call it a tale of two schools. I walked into a classroom in East Los Angeles at Garfield High School in 1982 and met a teacher named Jaime Escalante. They later made a movie about him, Stand and Deliver, but nobody had ever heard of him then, and he was telling me things that blew my mind. And I spent 5 years at his school, which everybody thought was a terrible school because it was, you know, lots of very poor kids, low test scores. And I realized at the end of the 5 years writing a book about it that it was one of the best schools I'd ever seen, because that school was challenging its kids, even its average kids, particularly its low-income kids, and showing that they have the potential to do much more, to pass an AP test, the most difficult test we give high school students in the United States. They had the potential to pass those tests if you gave them more time and encouragement to learn. So that was the first school. The second school was Mamaroneck High School in Westchester County, a very wealthy school, a public school with lots of kids from wealthy families. And everyone thought that was a great school. I moved there with my family in the 90s because my wife got a job in New York City. And everybody thought that was a great school, and I began to talk to people there. And I realized it was not a good school at all. It was very different from Garfield back in poverty-stricken East L.A. because it restricted its kids. It wouldn't let its average students take advanced placement tests or courses because it thought that those average kids wouldn't be able to do well in them. Can you see the problem here? They mm-hmm. realized at Garfield that even poor kids could do well if you gave them more time and encouragement. At Mamaroneck High, a very wealthy public school, they didn't know that. They didn't understand that, and they restricted access to courses and tests, which I think are the most interesting and enlivening and best things we have going in high schools in the U.S. today.
So is that what gave you the impetus to start this index?
Right. I wrote a book about Garfield, and then I wrote a book about Mamaroneck, and needed some device to dramatize the point I was making. And it occurred to me, we up to then and still today, we mostly rate schools, high schools, by test scores, usually mm-hmm. SAT scores or state test scores. Who has the highest average test score? But that's not a measure of the school. That's a measure of the parents. If the more money your parent is making, the more likely you will score well on these tests. So to measure the school, I thought the best way to do that was to take the advanced placement and also the similar tests like International Baccalaureate and Cambridge and count how many of those tests each school gave each year to its kids, which is a measure of how much they're trying to challenge kids. The more tests they were giving, the more kids were being challenged, because you only take the test after you've taken this very difficult course.
But
so I count the number of tests, and I divide that each year by the size of the graduating senior class, so that a big school like Plano in outside of Dallas, which has 1,000 kids graduating, doesn't have any advantage over a little school that has only about 100 kids graduating. And that so, you know, I started that. I just as an experiment in 1998, and I've been doing it. It hit a nerve. Lots of parents liked it. There's lots of discussion about it, some argument about it. But I think it's a great way to measure which schools are better than others, rather than measuring which parents are richer than others.
There's a lot in there to unpack, it seemed to me. If schools are challenging their students, that's probably a very good thing. I think on the face of it, that's a good thing. But what's more important, the fact that the school challenges their students or that the students are up to the challenge, that they perform well?
The problem is you don't know if they're up to the challenge until you give it to them. Most of our high schools are very mediocre. They do their best, but their idea is to not stress kids too much, don't give them too much work, and that is what has led to the fact that there has been no significant increase in reading or math scores for teenagers in our schools for 30 years. It's been a flat line all that time. And I think one of the reasons is that we simply don't understand how much potential our kids have, and we don't give them enough of a challenge. The average high school senior, the average high school student in the United States does less than an hour of homework a night. I think that's one indication of how little we ask them to do.
You've been doing this survey, first in Newsweek, now in the Washington Post, or this index, for 20 years. You've written 5 books about high schools. We've seen stories in the national media, both in print and on television, about various schools that do demand a lot of their students. And invariably, those stories report that those students do well because of the challenge, because they realize that the teacher is interested in them, that there are expectations, and they don't want to fail to meet those expectations.
Exactly.
So it's become relatively well known that if you raise the expectations, the kids are going to meet it.
I don't think it's nearly as well known as it ought to be.
Okay.
The first year of the index in 1998, I could only find 243 schools, 1% of the total in the United States, who had at least as many AP or IB or Cambridge tests as they had graduating seniors, 1%. Now we're up to 12% of American high schools reach that standard that gets you on the list. But that strikes me as still a very low number. The only thing you have to do to get on my list is to have half of your seniors and half of your juniors take one AP test that year. Seems to me we should have many more schools on the list. Most of them still don't understand that this challenge is important. Most of them still worry about overstressing kids.
But I think that's
wrong.
But why? Between your test, between your index and the stories that we've seen, and the fact that education seems to be among the most data-driven businesses I've ever seen, why don't more people know about this in education?
Because there is in the land, among teachers in particular, and lots of other people, this feeling that, oh, our high schools are too hard. There's a movie called Race to Nowhere that's gotten very popular in communities, particularly wealthy communities around the country, that argues we're overstressing our kids. We give them too much AP tests. There's a very popular movie. It's a documentary. It has no data in it, but lots of feelings. And it has no facts. It's wrong. If you go talk to teachers or parents, they say, oh, they're giving my kid too much work. But the data, the facts show that the opposite is true. We're not giving our kids enough work.
Obviously, you want to challenge kids, and data says that if you challenge them, most of them will do their best to meet the challenge. But there are those kids who will not meet the challenge, who will fall behind, who will not succeed, who will fail. So what is the impact if you raise the level of expectation? What's the impact on those students who just can't keep up?
That's a wonderful question, and it allows me to explain something that very few people understand. In low-income schools, which have lots of kids who've not been well challenged and don't have good preparation for courses, like CMS, when you change the policy and give those kids a chance to take something very difficult, like AP or IB, what happens is that they appreciate the chance to take a course that the smart kids are taking. They appreciate teachers telling them, you know, maybe you haven't done so well in the past, but we're going to give you more time to learn. I'm going to encourage you. Let's see what happens. What happens is, say, some of them don't pass the final exam, but they come out of that, and I've interviewed hundreds of kids who have this experience. They come out of the experience saying, wow, I could do much. I learned much more in that class, even though I flunked the final exam, than I would in a regular class. And I now know that I'm much readier for college than I would be if I hadn't challenged myself. About two-thirds of American seniors try to graduate and try to go to college. Only half of those kids ever take an AP or an IB course. And those that do, particularly in low-income environments, really appreciate the experience. You'll find in rich schools, if a kid flunks an AP or IB test, you know, there's some worry about that because most of their friends are passing. But the vast majority of people are not in such schools. They are in regular schools or low-income schools, and those kids really appreciate having that opportunity.
Jay Matthews is the creator of America's Most Challenging High Schools Index. When we come back, we'll talk about something he did for us here at WFAE, and that was to take a look at Charlotte's high schools. And then we'll meet two folks who are intimately aware of what's going on in Charlotte's high schools as well. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Jay Matthews, education writer and columnist for The Washington Post and creator of the America's Most Challenging High Schools Index, is still with us. He created a regional index for Charlotte schools that we've been talking, well, we haven't talked about it yet, but we're about to. But now we're also going to be joined by a former CMS superintendent. Dr. Eric Smith expanded the AP program in the district during his tenure here from 1996 to 2002, which, by the way, Dr. Smith, may be a world record for somebody holding that position.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be with you.
Good. He joins us by phone from New York. He's an educational consultant. And with us in our Spirit Square studios, Dr. Frank Barnes, Chief Equity Officer for Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools. He recently joined CMS from the Boston Public Schools, where he held the same job since 2008. You're glutton for punishment. Welcome.
It's good to be here, Mike. Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you here. So, Jay, I'm going to start again with you because we haven't talked about how Charlotte high schools have been faring, and I think we asked you to take a deep dive into Charlotte high schools. Had any Charlotte area high schools been included in your index prior to our asking about it?
Oh yes, for many years. It is one of the best districts in the country when measured by participation in a college level test like AP, IB, and Cambridge. It's an amazing place. And a lot of this dates back to what Dr. Smith did 20 years ago.
And how many high schools, Charlotte high schools, on average, are included in the
19 Charlotte MEC high schools are qualifier for inclusion in the list this year. That's 19 out of, I believe, 33 schools. Have I got that right, Frank?
That's correct.
That's a huge number. Both big city districts in the United States will, you know, manage to get maybe two or three if they're really paying attention, but 19 means that the teachers and principals in this district have been really paying attention to this for a long time and have made wonderful progress in tapping that untapped potential, particularly of low-income kids.
So Jay Matthews just mentioned your name, Dr. Smith, and he has both written about this story, and I saw that you wrote about this story in your own explanation of your time here, and that is that early in your tenure as superintendent of schools, somebody rolled a cart stacked with data into your office, and the good news was that he handed you a small stack of papers that was information on all on the minority students in AP classes. And the better news was that there was a bigger stack of papers of minority students who weren't taking AP classes but could be if they were given the opportunity. What did you discover? Did a light bulb go off in your head at that point?
Well, it did. It led to a huge awareness about the untapped potential of so literally hundreds and thousands of students in Charlotte-Mecklenburg. at the time, ones students that we weren't challenging, that we weren't encouraging to get in the game. And why was that?
Was that because educators at the time, and perhaps even today, just simply believe that there is a subset of students who aren't up to the challenge?
I don't think there's anything sinister. I didn't find anything sinister in it. I found that it was a lot of well-intentioned educators that really wanted to try to protect students from being harmed by being asked to do too much, and that falls right into a trap of an expectation that some kids, because of their background so forth, are just not able to deal with it. And so we exclude a lot of kids. AP is an example of where we can see it most starkly. But that same expectation we found to occur in when kids move from elementary to middle school in mathematics, we found a huge shift in students that have huge potential coming out of elementary that just fall off the cliff and are put into basic because of their backgrounds. And again, I didn't see it as really a sinister work, but it ended up being that way. It ended up doing harm to kids that could do so much. You know,
yeah.
If I can for a second, we had a different philosophy, I think, than some districts when we started out. We had an overarching mission to equity, and where the country was pretty much focused on basic skills and achieving the grade level performance, and whether or not kids were able to do grade level work, and the whole assessment business was beginning to roll out at that point in time. We had a belief that doing the grade level work wasn't good enough for any child, that wasn't going to get them into college and wasn't going to get them into a good career. Well, we had to measure two things. One, were we getting kids up to the grade level work? And then how were we doing getting kids up to the best and the brightest? And were we doing that in an equitable way? Were we forcing that middle group as we move kids up into the basic? Were we being able to move them beyond that through the middle and into the high level of performance? And what are the strategies required to do that? So that's what kind of got us into that work. It led us to a whole very strategic array of strategies that were focused on increasing high-level performance in an equitable fashion, kids from all backgrounds and all walks of life.
I'm going to take it that since I have the chief equity officer in front of me from CMS, that is still the thrust?
It is. What we wanted to do is we're looking at how many of our students are getting access to extra challenge. We wanted to change our mindsets in some places. I think in some institutions, in some communities, AP or IB courses are seen more of a commodity or a privilege. Mm-hmm. We recognize it as more of an opportunity and a necessity.
Why? Why do we see it that way? Why are we in that small packet of school districts that see it that way?
I think the key thing is we're thinking about preparation or education for what or to what end. We want to create vibrant community citizens and thinkers and change makers, but we also want to prepare them for their next step in their journey, whether it be direct service, whether it be a pursuit of an education immediately, a two-year, four-year school, or direct entrance into work. And so the better we can prepare our students to be able to develop problem-solving skills, to work together on teams, to be able to be analytical and critical thinkers, and to persist when they meet a struggle, an intellectual struggle, the better they'll be prepared for
this,
that.
This seems like common sense to me. And yet you're among a small group of school systems that recognize this and act on it. Why? I don't understand. What I'm trying to get to is why are we in this group of enlightened school districts?
Well, I think you can't begrudge or set aside the leadership that people like Dr. Smith and his administration led in laying a foundation for this. I would say currently it's easier because of the work that he laid. But we really fundamentally believe, I think, in Charlotte and Mecklenburg County, that education can be transformative. It can be build bridges and not build walls and obstacles.
I'm never going to get an answer to that question as to why, but that's okay.
I got one.
Okay.
I've thought about this for a long time. I think the problem is that teaching is one of the most humane professions anybody could choose. You go into teaching, you love kids, you want to help kids. And when you're facing the prospect of giving that kid something really difficult and challenging, your human instincts stop you. Say, well, this may be too hard on that kid. I love kids. I don't want to hurt them. That instinct from we have in some of our best teachers, because they're wonderful people, is what slows down our ability to challenge kids.
So 2 decades ago, Dr. Smith, when you were presented with this information, I'm told it did not surprise you that, and correct me if I'm wrong, that it did not surprise you that there were a whole bunch of students who were not taking AP who could, and they would be successful if they did. So what did you do with that information 2 decades ago?
Yeah, so we did see that. You know, we saw the data. We knew what was going on. We had a process called project management that the Hugh McCall and Ed Crutchfield and some of the banks and Duke Power helped us establish in our district. That gave us a planning mechanism to really break down how we were going to do our work. And one of the things that we would discuss, we met in our project management team every week. And one of the things that really plagued me was, we had seen an uptick in our reading and math performance for all students, African-American, low-income, whatever. And we saw an uptick, but I didn't see that same change translate into the advanced placement performance or even enrollment. And I raised that question to my project management team. And with that, I gave the team the College Board, who does the advanced placement, they put out an annual report that had a correlation table buried in the back of the report. And the correlation table connects PSAT performance to AP performance for every AP exam offered by the College Board. And I looked at that and I said, I don't know why we don't have this number of students, this percentage of students performing. And Mike Huggins and his team he's the one that plugged it into the computer and ran out the numbers. And lo and behold, he comes rolling down at 5 o'clock one night, this cart that was just absolutely amazing, the discrepancy and the difference. And so we went to digging deeper and well, why is this happening? And one of the things that is not surprising, we found that schools at large minority populations, they weren't even offering the same number of AP courses, even though they had a large number of students that would be attending other schools. And even the schools that were considered, quote, good schools in Charlotte-Mecklenburg weren't offering as many as they should be. And so even in your opening, I heard your opening talking about the number of AP courses being offered at East Mecklenburg and other high schools around. That's astounding. You won't find that in most districts in America, any school that offers that many AP offerings to their children. Yet they have children that are showing potential for success in those areas. So we found a lot of equity issue and lack of access, a lot of equity issue in lack of encouragement and support, and a lot of equity issue in things like offering AVID and other kinds of programs that will help prepare kids to be successful if they're given a chance to take an AP course.
So Jay Matthews mentioned a moment ago that there are 19 CMS high schools that qualified for inclusion on this index, which is a remarkable number when you compare it to other school systems around the country. It's a distinction earned by only 12% of all U.S. schools. So Dr. Barnes, how surprised do you think most Charlatans would be about that fact? Because CMS gets a bad rap locally, but nationally we keep being told we're like the poster child for excellence.
Well, I can't speak to how surprised some of our community members may be. I do think that our community has high expectations for what our school system offers our students. And to be able to have someone like Jay to be able to report in the Washington Post that here's what he's seeing, what I'll call an objective lens, is encouraging, because it is a constant struggle to be able to say, how can we take the resources, the finite resources we have, and create advanced courses? We're still working to push to create more advanced courses, AP courses, in more high schools, particularly high schools with higher concentrations of poverty, and that's always going to be something that we're going to be pushing on.
How many high schools do we have at CMS?
Currently, we have 33.
33. So some of the schools, Jay, did not make the list. 19 did. At the top of the list, Ardrey Kell, Myers Park, Providence, Huff, South Meck, East Meck, and it goes on down. At the bottom of the list, the bottom four, Olympic, Mallard Creek, West Charlotte, and Independence. What's the difference between the top five and the bottom four, Jay?
Well, I think one is that the ones on the bottom generally have more low-income students than the ones at the top. I think that, although there you will see really good schools that make the list from CMS that have a lot of low-income kids, it's tougher to make this work. And the point you made about, you know, people's assumptions, sadly, in our country, we have an unspoken and undiscussed assumption that if you see a school with lots of poor kids, you assume those kids aren't very good students, and you assume that school is bad. Gradually, with school districts like Charlotte, we're breaking through that impression and showing that schools with lots of low-income kids can do very well. But it's harder. You know, you have to persuade the kid and the family that they can do this. And second, you have to give them more resources. Dr. Barnes mentioned the AVID program, the largest college prep program in the country, which has been for the last 30 years finding ways to prepare kids for AP or IB, and mostly average kids, below average kids, by giving them they have this way of tutoring kids, which is mind-blowing. The kid comes in every couple times a week with the problems in their homework that they've struggled with, and they sit there in a group of other kids and a tutor, and the other kids ask the kid with the problem leading questions about the difficulty he's having, so to help him think it through and get to the right approach and answer himself. I don't think there's any other tutoring system that does that, but it prepares kids for college, because that's what you have to do in college. If you run into a problem, you have to think it through.
There are actually three Olympic high schools on this list, which we'll talk about in a second when we come back. But you can participate in a poll on the WFAE website about the best way to judge the quality of a high school. You can go to wfae.org/Charlotte Talks and click on today's show page. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the America's Most Challenging High School Index, which Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools does very, very, very well on. It is the creation of Jay Matthews, an education writer and columnist for the Washington Post. He's been doing this for 20 years, first in Newsweek, now in the Post. He joins us from Pasadena, California. Dr. Eric Smith, former superintendent of schools here at CMS, who kind of really began a push to bring more students into AP and IB classes, and Dr. Frank Barnes, who is here now as the Chief Equity Officer of Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools. I mentioned that there are 19 high schools of the 33 high schools on this list, which is an incredibly high number, according to Jay Matthews, for any school district to have. And I mentioned the top schools and some of the bottom schools, and I put in there Olympic, but that's Olympic Renaissance, a little higher on the list, Olympic Biotech Health Public Administration, and higher still on the list, Olympic Math, Engineering, Tech, Science. How do you explain that they're at three different levels at the same school?
Well, up until this year, there had been individual schools at one large complex. So what you had is individual principals, individual schedules, and different approaches for how they created their master schedule and created opportunity in their schools. Now the schools are consolidated, and what we're aspiring to do is to make sure that all the students at each of what used to be different schools at that same school have those same opportunities.
So WFAE's Gwendolyn Glenn has been doing a series of reports on this, and tomorrow on WFAE you can hear her report on how well East Mecklenburg High School challenges its students. That's on Morning Edition, and you can read all of her stories and our stories as a station on the Challenge Index and CMS from Jay Matthews at WFAE.org. You can see whether your high school made the list as well. But Gwendolyn reports that at East Mecklenburg, a school whose demographics would suggest that it would rank low in academic achievement, This approach, this of bringing students into AP, not only are those students cutting it, but those students are learning that many of their own self-perceptions have turned out to be wrong. Talk about that, Drs. Barnes and Smith. I want you both to talk about what that means to a student.
If I could just jump in for a second, because on that issue, you said something earlier in this broadcast about a process that I'm very happy is still continued today with this push to get more kids into AP. That when the lists are generated with kids that have potential, that a letter is sent home to mom and dad. And that letter was written back in the late 1990s. And that was part of our original strategy, was that we didn't want to call the child into the guidance department and say, you're going to be scheduled to. We wanted mom and dad notified that their child, their son or daughter, had been identified with great potential to do college-level work in high school. And we wanted the initiation of this decision-making, I'm going to be a part of this, to come from the student and from the student's parents, not from just the administration and the faculty. And so I do think that there are many issues that go into this. There's the technical side, educational side, opportunity, support, preparation. But there's also this emotional side of what is within the child and their realization that they can do more, that their potential is higher, and their mom and dad's expectation that they can do more and they can be a part of this move. So I think that's one major element of the whole effort, is that we're trying to change minds and hearts as well as academic performance.
We hear so many stories about young people who go to school and don't do well, or because they're not well prepared, because they're not getting the help they need at home, because there's no tradition of reading to a child before they go to school and preschool, et cetera, and that the light goes out in their eyes by the third or fourth grade and they fall behind their peers. And then school becomes this miserable, unhappy experience for them, and they think less of themselves. When you are considered to be an average student or maybe a below-average student with little potential, why would you want to go to that place every single day? But if you say that you are identifying young people who do have that potential, who have slipped through the cracks, and now you're telling them that you have that potential, they're no longer suffering from the tyranny of low expectation. What does that do for the child, Dr. Barnes?
Well, I think it transforms how they see themselves. See, perception and aspiration and belief are interesting things. And so you can have facts which have been your history and say, that's based on those facts, that's who I am. We confront those facts with new information about themselves. So we administer the PSAT, which is a test we give to all of our 10th and 11th graders from the College Board, and we use those data in the same school year to identify students who have what we call advanced placement potential, potential they may not know they have. So building on what Dr. Smith explained, we recruit students and tell them, did you know how smart that you are, and how much, if you just pushed yourself and persisted, spent more time, which we'll give you, have more support, which we'll give you, how far you could rise, to see students light up. Some of them sometimes don't want that challenge, but we say you can meet it and we'll meet it with you.
They don't want it because they don't think they can meet the challenge, that they'll fail yet again. Is that what it is?
I think that's the case in many cases. But here's something that's interesting that we found in empirical research, is that for black students and low-income students, we also see it in girls, they are more receptive and responsive to what they think we think of them. Now, I want to say it's not what we think of them. It's their perception of what we think of them. And when they see that we believe in them, mm-hmm. we sometimes have to believe before they believe, and it helps them to persist and work harder given the support and time they need.
So there will be bumps in the road for a person who comes into an AP, whether you would have concluded from the get-go that they were AP-qualified students, or whether you've discovered that they have the potential to be, and therefore you put them in the AP program, and they meet expectations. But there will be bumps in the road. So when you're dealing with these kids, does it take a special teacher to get them over those bumps in the road?
I won't say a special teacher, but you need a skilled teacher, a teacher who's skilled at teaching the content in a diversity of ways, a teacher who's skilled at building relationships and building trust, a teacher who's skilled at being able to figure out how do I give kids who need a little extra help to reach higher, give them that opportunity, and not make them feel condemned or guilty because they need the help. And also a teacher who's skilled enough to say, I know you might be struggling, but I'm not lowering the bar because lowering the bar is not helping you.
So, Jay Matthews, go ahead, Eric.
Excuse me. I think the challenges for a classroom teacher are just huge. They're it's overwhelming in many cases, and we realize that. And that's where the program AVID that Jay had mentioned was so useful, because it helps students, particularly students low income and so forth, that might not get as much conversation around the dinner table at night about how to do well in school. It actually teaches these kids how to take notes. It teaches these kids how to ask a good question in class. It teaches the kids to sit in the front of the classroom, don't sit in the back. It does help support with tutoring and so forth. But so much more. It teaches the kids how to read a textbook and do homework at night.
And I think, Jay, I've read in one of your articles, I think it was you that wrote this, that a lot of times people think that bringing these kids who would not normally be identified as being AP students into AP classes, it does not lower the effectiveness of that class for other students. And in fact, those other students who think they belong there because it's on their life path discover that these kids who are coming in who maybe don't belong there or they think they don't belong are actually asking great questions which advance the class.
It's one of the great, most interesting things I've ever discovered getting into classrooms. I knew a teacher in Alexandria, Virginia, who had five sections of government classes for seniors. Everybody had to take that course in Virginia. And he made sure each of those classes had seven kids who were taking the AP version of government, and he had them all taught at the same time, and the discussions, he said, were amazing, because the kids who weren't AP students and probably from poorer homes had all kinds of great ideas, interesting takes on government issues. The AP students were impressed by that. That class bonded, and it showed once again that the kids that we think aren't don't have the potential, well, they do, and if you open it up, wonderful things happen.
There's even more good news after we asked you to take this deep dive into Charlotte. You say that Charlotte's highest-ranking schools on your index, Ardrey Kell and Myers Park, match up to private schools like Charlotte Latin and Charlotte Country Day, and that some of our schools with majority low-income students show more promise, if that's the best word to use, than other low-income population schools in other areas. So I have to ask, what's income got to do with it? Sounds like a song.
I think we all know that if you grow up in a low-income house, your parents are going to be distracted by making a living. They probably will not have graduated from college or maybe not have graduated from high school. So their ability to put you in a place where you will be able to do well in school, to make sure that you have lots of books in the home, talk to you a lot, talking to your kids from the time they're little, and having a lot of words in their life is very important, the research shows. The low-income parents just have a lot of other things on their plate, and they don't understand how much just talking to their kids would help. Once you explain that to parents like that, they get the picture, and they know how much potential they have that they haven't tapped into yet.
But, Mike, I also think it's an issue of what we would call cultural capital. Some of the things that you would get in, say, an AVID course or that kind of supplemental work, taking notes, time management, transferable skills, how to organize yourself. So as students meet more academic press, they know how to survive in those environments because they can make meaning of text, they can organize themselves, they can figure out how do they manage all the other demands in their life and still devote the time they need to schoolwork. So some of the money issues, it's not always the money, although tutoring and extra help works after school, but it's also being able to be in an environment where those cultural capital that are transferable to the workplace are so invaluable in the classroom.
So Jay reports that CMS does not allow every student to take an AP or an IB course, and that there are some college board prerequisites for taking certain courses that he says don't make sense and over which CMS has little control. But he also takes issue with CMS's policy of students needing to be admitted to IB magnet programs that require those admitted to read on grade level and pass at least 3 IB courses each year. He says those barriers hurt students who would do better if exposed to IB subject matter. What do you say to that?
We're on a journey in trying to figure out how do we expand access in all of our magnet programs. A first step on that journey was being able to remove some of those prerequisites for some of our other magnet programs. We're always looking at how can we maintain the fidelity of the program as well as be able to open the doors as wide as possible. So that's a journey that we're on, and I think we've made some positive steps even in the last 18 months.
And I want to read something, Jay, that you wrote. CMS sometimes, as I said, gets short shrift from locals who for whatever reason do not see our schools the way outsiders see our schools. So let me read something you've written about us. You describe CMS as a district committed to learning beyond the boring basics, where classrooms vibrate with genuine effort by teachers and students teaming together to conquer a college-level exam. And you go on to say that AP and IB were once seen as just for rich kids, but at CMS, average students, including those whose parents never went to college, are welcomed in. So then how would you rank CMS as a system against other systems in the country?
It's in the top 10 large school districts in the country, without any question. What you've read there is the great dynamic. The usual high school class dynamic is, well, you know, you complain to the teacher about, you got too many, you know, you're asking about too many battles. Can you ease in that test? You know, it's too hard for us. And in a regular class, the teacher will compromise often and will dumb it down. In an AP class, the teacher can say to those kids and their parents, sorry, I'd love to do that. I know you want your kids to have an easy time here. But if I do that, I'm preparing them for a course and a test that I do not write and I do not grade. If I do it the easy way, they're going to flunk that test. Mm-hmm. And that's irresponsible of me. So I have to be tough on them. And that changes the dynamic. It becomes a team, the students and the teacher together, working together to beat that test, and it changes everything.
Jay Matthews is the creator of the America's Most Challenging High Schools Index, which ranks Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools pretty darned high. Dr. Eric Smith is the guy we can credit with putting us on this path when he was superintendent of schools here back in the 90s and early 2000s, and Dr. Frank Barnes is in charge of it now, chief equity officer at CMS. You can participate in a poll on the WFAE website about the best way to judge the quality of a high school. You go to wfae.org/charlottetalks. And click on today's show page. And tomorrow you can hear WFAE reporter Gwendolyn Glenn's look at how well East Mecklenburg High School challenges its students. That's on Morning Edition. And you can read all of our stories on the Challenge Index and CMS from Jay Matthews on WFAE.org. And while you're there, don't forget to see whether your school made the list. Thanks for joining us this hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.